So our first speaker is John Schellenhuber, who has a CV that is much too long to go through here, but key points are that he's director of the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research and a past director of the Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research. And those two institutions have been at the forefront, I guess, of thinking about climate change from a multidisciplinary perspective for a number of years, the last 10 years. And we're really looking forward to John's talk now about conceiving of what we might be getting into going beyond 2 degrees.
Seems to work. Yeah. Okay, so thanks a lot, Mark, for the nice introduction. The title of my talk is Terra Quasi Incognita, Beyond the 2 Degrees Line. So I wrote a very nice abstract, but now I have to live up to the standard and to provide you with a picture and, in a sense, setting this, the stage, the scene. It's very nice to have Richard Betts and Nigel Arnell following up, because we will talk about sort of the regional patterns and the impacts. I will talk actually about two things, namely the 2 degrees line, if you like, and the rationale for it, but also what if we cannot hold that line. And it's true that there is increasing evidence that it will be extremely difficult to do so. So I'll, in a sense, do a tour d'horizon and also talk about what is necessary in terms of emissions reductions for holding that line and what happens if we cannot hold that line. And I'll end with something which is too scary to think of, so there is no solid scientific research on it, that is what we call a runaway greenhouse effect or a limited runaway greenhouse effect, and I'll present some very preliminary thinking about that, which we have done at the Potsdam Institute. Anders Liebermann, who is here and also will give a talk, has pioneered this. I think it's a very interesting subject, at least intellectually, where we want to have the empirical evidence is a different thing. Let's see. Anyway, so just to get to warm up, I mean, I'd just like to remind you that last week there was a very nice article, feature article in Nature on the so-called planetary boundaries. Diana Liverman, who is also here, and myself have been authors of that. And this is not just about climate change as one of the environmental spaces where we have to think of boundaries and confinement, but it is also about 8 other dimensions, if you like, of planetary environmental space, including the nitrogen cycle, about species extinction, and so on. And actually, it turns out that for 3 of the 9 sectors, if you like, dimensions, we are beyond the boundaries where we think, as a scientific community, this is too dangerous to venture into that terrain. And we even come up with numbers, and they will be debated fiercely, of course, that's the idea. So there will be a very heavy online discussion on that. So you may join in. But anyway, on climate change, on biodiversity loss, and on the nitrogen cycle, we clearly are in the red zone already. I'll focus clearly on climate change now, and maybe just as a reminder, because in 1995, when the in a sense, this was the birth year of the 2 degrees target, if you like. So I was at that time already a member of the German Advisory Council on Global Change, and we invented what is called the tolerable windows approach, which is an inverse approach. Yeah? So you do not just guess what the emissions will be and when you look at the impacts and whether this is something you should avoid or not, but you do it the other way around. You say, what are the things on Earth we don't want to see, like species loss and so on? And when you work yourself backwards, and this is highly nonlinear physics, actually, fairly difficult mathematics as well, and so we came up with very good reasons why 2 degrees should be the upper limit of global warming. It has also to do with, in a sense, the evolution of Homo sapiens on this planet, because you look at the variations of climate over these 100,000 years, or 200,000 years, you even add a safety margin, and then you still come up with something like a statement that more than 2 degrees is dangerous territory, so you should avoid it. But in the years since that time, 1995, a lot of evidence has been added to that. I'll quickly run through that. So, but before I do that, this is, in a sense, a very important statement at an unimportant meeting, namely the G8 summit in L'Aquila in Italy this year. The G8 is more or less obsolete now. It will be the G20. Some people say it will only be the G2, which is relevant in the future. You know, the US and China. But the G20 probably is a political platform which is very important. And to my own surprise, the 2 degrees target, in a sense, was acknowledged and was supported. In Copenhagen, we actually make it a sort of, under the UN Convention, a full acknowledgement and maybe even an adoption of the 2 degrees target. But it's probably the best we can get in Copenhagen, because nobody should dream of the possibility that there will be numbers, reduction measures for each country in the world, which will be sealed in Copenhagen this year. That's almost impossible. But if we get, first of all, a long-term target, and second, we get the right framework, when we are in much better shape than we are now, and then it will take another 12 months probably to seal the deal. That is my own projection, but I hope I will be proven wrong. Anyway, so last IPCC report, Martin Parris and others have amassed a lot of evidence why 2 degrees is something which we should be. Now, these are temperature degrees, centigrades above the 1990s, more or less. And you see all these arrows where something dramatic may happen, single events or water shortage and so on, somehow start after another degree of warming. So if you add the 0.7, 0.8 we had since the Industrial Revolution, you are more or less in the 2 degrees range. And you see, so the impact landscape of this planet gets congested if you are beyond these 2 degrees. And the same is true if you do it for the national level, so for the regions here. So you see, so whether you run through Africa or Australia, New Zealand, and so on, you see that add another degree warming, and then the impacts will start. Now, let's see whether Nigel will support this statement or not, but that is at least the outcome of the IPCC. Now, you can do a little bit more. When I was involved as a coordinating lead author in the IPCC third assessment report, we came up with what is now called the burning embers diagram. That is a sort of traffic light presentation of what can be seen as dangerous. So that is the 2001 reasons for concern. So you have five categories, if you like. Threatened ecosystems, for example, like coral reefs. You have risk of extreme weather. And you have the large-scale discontinuities, like the meltdown of the Greenland ice sheet. And at that time, we thought, above the past, you see, that was our color coding at that time, based on the impacts research. When does things become dangerous in the various categories? Now, if you compare it with the 2 degrees guardrail, so which is a formal decision by the European Union to confine global warming to that, and you see the 2 degrees target looks pretty okay. It's a compromise. So, of course, we will lose all the coral reefs if we go up to 2 degrees, or most of them, but who needs coral reefs anyway? And so, but we will at least save the Greenland ice sheet, blah, blah, blah. And so in the end, this is a good political compromise. But if you look at the recent work, which was published in PNAS this year by Joel Smith and others, when all the red color is coming down in all the columns, so that is a quite dramatic finding. And 10,000 of studies have gone into that. This is the stark evidence that 2 degrees is not certainly a very good line, but we are talking at this conference of going even beyond the 2 degrees. So this is still a political compromise. You see, at least when it comes to tipping points and so on, which I will comment in a minute, we are not in the red-hot area yet, but for other things like ecosystems, we are in the deep red zone already if we go, according to our state of art, of course. I mean, these are all projections. In the end, the proof is in the pudding. That means the proof is in warming the planet by more than 2 degrees, when we will find out for sure what the real effects are. An interesting experiment, but maybe we should avoid it. So there has been a Copenhagen conference already this year. Diana is also well aware of that, organized by the research universities, including Oxford University. In March this year, 2,000 scientists attended. It was a very interesting. There is a synthesis report, like an IPCC report, which you can find on the website. And this was, in a sense, supporting the view of the scientific community that 2 degrees, in a sense, is the maximum which we should accept in order to deal with the impacts of that. And finally, I should mention this, here in the UK at least, we organized a meeting under the auspices of Prince of Wales in St. James Palace in May this year. You also can find a number of statements. It's called the St. James Palace Memorandum. By the way, it was 20 Nobel laureates were present, including Steve Chu. He attended for 3 days. All the lectures discussed things. He's, by the way, the head of the energy department in the U.S., and this memorandum has been signed by about 50 Nobel laureates now, including Gorbachev and the Dalai Lama, which is interesting. And it says, for example, the 2 degrees is something which we should take very seriously. Global emissions should peak by 2015. Now, 2015 is not far away from today. At least 50% reduction. So this is the usual IPCC folklore and is in line with what say, but finally, and this is the next part of my talk, a total carbon budget should be considered, because I'll come to that immediately. Nature and physics is providing us with an extremely simple yardstick for measuring what climate protection is all about. We are very lucky, actually, because the whole Earth system is an extremely nonlinear machinery. But nevertheless, a very simple metric supplies. Namely, just add up all the tons of CO2 you release into the atmosphere over 50 years from now, and that gives you, to the first order at least, the global warming you will get. That's very interesting, and many, many models have been used for providing that evidence. So nobody can say anymore it's too complicated, we cannot make any clear decisions. The policymakers are confronted with this stark and very inconvenient truth, which I will present now to you. There was a Nature cover story, The Coming Climate Crunch, that was, I think, in April, 23rd of April or something, where two groups, in particular Malte Meinshausen from Potsdam, together with colleagues, and Miles Allen here from Oxford, came up more or less with a similar approach, the budget approach, and it means more or less between the year 2000 and the year 2050, humanity is allowed to release about 1,000 gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere, to the first order of our physics, climate physics. Unfortunately, we have eaten up already 300 in the first 10 years, so we are left with 700, 750 or something. If we want to have at least a 75% chance of holding the 2 degrees line, which is, by the way, not a brilliant chance. So if you would do that in a calculation of a nuclear power plant, so probably people would feel very uncomfortable if we would sit next to a plant where a 25% chance of getting it blown up would exist, but it's only about the planet we are talking about, so it's no problem. The very stark truth, which has not been published yet, I think Malte Meinshausen and others did. I mean, because we have this budget approach, it simply means what counts is the area under the emissions curve. Now, this is the global emissions curves in gigatons carbon equivalent here, and you see that's what happened between 1990 and now, so the curve is still climbing. And what would be, in order to have a 75% probability for the 2 degrees target, what will be the profiles needed in the future in order to have this probability confirmed? And you see, if we would immediately peak next year, because of Copenhagen, with global emissions, when we would have to do every year a 2% reduction of emissions, which sounds very feasible. But now the vicious integral strikes. Integrals can be very vicious, as you may know, and this is one of the instances. If you wait another 5 years when this amounts already to 3.6% reductions in a linear world here, but if you wait till 2020, which is much more likely, when you will have to reduce every year by 6%, and that is seems already unfeasible, and then you go on and on. No? And in particular, you should note, so that's a 6, but if you wait a little bit longer, you actually end up, starting with the year 2040, with negative emissions. That is, you have to extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, which may be done. I had a nice chat with Klaus Lackner from the Earth Institute at Columbia last week. But it can be done in principle, but it cannot be done in practice. That's the problem. I mean, it's different from the French way. Generals say, well, it works in practice, but does it work in theory? So you should be very worried about it. But here, I think we really have to work in practice. Now, the German Advisory Council on Global Change, which is the top-level advisory board for the German government on all environmental issues, which I chair currently, did a report where you just put together the budget approach, the 2 degrees line, and you ask what the nations have to do now if you take this scientific evidence seriously, because there's no point in Copenhagen to talk about wonderful 2 degrees target, but you fool yourself about the emission reductions which are really necessary. So we broke down this whole thing nation by nation on an equal per capita emissions budget, but not equal per capita emissions in the year 2050, but as an integral over time, starting next year, so to speak. Yeah? So each person on this planet gets the same budget over time of CO2 emission. I think that sounds really fair. We even discard sort of historic responsibilities. But when it looks very bleak, so here is the formula. I skipped the formula. I come back to that. Thanks for the intervention. That's precisely what I wanted to. This is Miles Elm, by the way. But I'll come to back to that later. No, here is the interesting truth. If we start with this budgeting of global CO2 next year, and we do it till the year 2050, and we say we start with the relative population weights, we calculate them next year. So people say, well, if you do equal per capita emission, when the Indians will double themselves and take home a lot of emission rights, that's complete nonsense. You just use a reference here, say next year, and when you have the relative population weights of the various nations, and when you assign and allocate the emissions, of course. And if you do that, and if you just want to have a probability of 2/3 of holding the 2 degrees line, then these are the various emission trajectories for the various countries. So the black line is the United States, because this is the per capita budget you have as a rectangular over the next 40 years. And in order to, the United States start out with 20 tons per capita per year of CO2. So you have to fall down to zero by 2020. When I presented this at a retreat with the Obama administration, when people said, of course, the Senate will never say yes to this. This is not grounded in political reality. So my answer was, but if political reality is not grounded in physical reality, it's completely useless. And that is precisely our problem. The next one is Germany here. You see, Germany is better off, but still it would have to phase out CO2 by the year 2030. And you can go on. China would have to peak by something like 2020 and phase out by 2035. This is the simple arithmetic only. Yeah? And so you have just countries like India who still have a sort of hump ahead and could use it. Now, there is actually a solution to that problem. This is another way of putting it. We put together the country the group one countries, more or less the OECD countries. Group two are the emerging economies, including India and China, and group three are the countries like Pakistan, Afghanistan, and so on, who still have a lot of emission space left, in a sense. Now, we saw for the groups lumped together the reduction lines. So you see, again, this very dreary line for the OECD countries. This is for the emerging economies, and this is for the really poor countries on this planet. But if you would now use, and that's the third thing, remember budgeting of CO2, second CO2, 2 degrees line, if you use emissions trading, then of course you can shift a lot of emission rights from the various countries to each other, and in particular the group three, you see, including in this case Pakistan, India, would have a very fairly flat development regarding CO2. So you see, the other countries would have more space, and in the end, everything converges more or less at the same equal per capita, emissions at around 2050. So if you have really massive emissions trading, which is feasible, by the way, because we did the calculations, when you still can hold the 2 degrees line. But it would mean it would be the biggest flux of money in history from the north to the south. In a sense, it would reverse the flux of money from the south to the north, which built the British Empire and many other interesting cultures. So, interesting perspective. Now I go beyond the 2 degrees line, because you may say what I showed you now may be the right physics and geography analysis, but it can't be done. We will not see these big fluxes of money, so we will rather try to go beyond the 2 degrees line and adapt to it. Now, how do we adapt to it? Now, this is a plot done by David Archer and others, which I think is one of the most iconic and most important plots ever done in a discussion of climate change. Nevertheless, it's very little known. It just tells you how global mean temperature and global sea level are related to each other. And we have just four or so points on this map, but nevertheless, it's more or less a straight line. Here we have a fairly linear relationship. It just tells you if we go to double CO2 on this planet in the long run, this is, of course, in equilibrium, there will be something like 50 meters sea level rise. So even the 2 degrees is something which will sink most of our coastlines. The good thing about it, it will take a few centuries, if not millennia, but nevertheless it will happen. Another thing we calculated, Matthias Hoffer and myself, we published this in PNAS this year, is about ocean acidification. This is another awakening giant. It has been ignored for quite some time, but it's going in an inexorable way forward, and in particular it means if we have unbridled climatic change, what we will see in the end is not so much sort of the carbon pump in the ocean will be suppressed, but there will be something like oxygen holes in the productive layer between 200 and 800 meters deep, which is very important for production of fish and so on. Because there will be a complete depletion of oxygen, which is a new finding. You see it here, for example, in the Indian Ocean. That would be one of the not much discussed yet effects of global warming, unbridled global warming. Oxygen holes, like the ozone holes you have in the stratosphere. Now, tipping points. We have published this work last year, Tim Lenton and a number of other people from Potsdam, from UEA, and so on. Has become a fairly well-referenced paper by now, and I give you some new evidence on this. For example, Ramanathan and Feng published a paper where we sort of used our metrics and showed even if we stop all greenhouse gas emissions overnight, but also clean the atmosphere from soot, black carbon, and all these things, the likely outcome will be a 2.4 degrees warming above pre-industrial level. And when you go along that line, you think Arctic summer sea ice will be lost probably fairly soon. Melting of the Himalayan glaciers will happen fairly soon. Greenland ice sheet somehow sits precisely at the maximum of this probability distribution function. By the way, this is the picture when we do not emit one more CO2 molecule in the future, which is fairly unlikely, I guess. And so on, Amazon rainforest, El Nino, thermal Hawaiian circulation. So in a sense, you see the metric, what is likely to happen if you go along beyond the 2 degrees line and then into this terra incognita, more or less. Now, Himalayan glacier, some speak about the third pole on this planet. You know, it's so important for the geophysical system, and it's also so important for the socioeconomic system, because almost all the Southeast Asian rivers are fed by the Himalayan glaciers or by the Karakoram or by the Hindu Kush and so on. So if these glaciers melt, then there will be no summer runoff for most of these rivers in the future. And so this will affect more than 1 billion people. Now, on the Greenland ice sheet, there's been a lot of discussion, of course. The numbers go up and down, how much regional warming is necessary for collapse it. The recent report by the British Antarctic Survey, published in Nature last week also, is fairly disturbing. It tells you that the melting is all over the place, really, and it goes faster than we thought. So Greenland, in a sense, is the global tipping point, if you like. And there is the really big giant in the game, that is the permafrost reservoirs of methane and other things. So the newest estimate is that over 1.5 trillion tons of carbon is stored there. And that's twofold the amount in the atmosphere, by the way. So if this is ever released, then we will be toast, of course. So we did some calculations. Run quickly through that, because that would be a research agenda for an entire conference. What would be the interaction between the various tipping points? So if you flip the Greenland ice sheet into annihilation, you will release a lot of fresh water. How will it affect the thermohaline circulation? How will this affect, for example, the stratification in the oceans, and so on, and so on, the summer monsoon. So there are a number of teleconnections on this planet, feedback loops. Nobody has ever looked at these things in detail. It's a fascinating research agenda, but it isn't pursued. That's the interesting thing. The mainstream is not doing that. Finally, I'm editing, and it will appear in the week of the Copenhagen conference, PNAS, a special feature, proceeding of the U.S. National Academy, on tipping points and tipping elements. And actually, two people here from Oxford have contributed to that. So Richard Washington and Yatvinder Mali is also here on the Amazon rainforest. So it will be on dust production on the planet. The Baudelaire depression, for example, is the biggest dust source on this planet, providing almost half of the dust export, which is very important for fertilizing the Amazon rainforest, for example. So the next one is Amazon rainforest. Anders Lieberman, who is also here, did work on the Indian summer monsoon. We have Mojib Latif from Kiel, who worked on the El Nino. We have work about ice sheets and Arctic sea ice. We have the oceanic marine carbon pump. We have David Archer, who did, together with his colleagues, the first ever model study on the methane cleft rates in the oceans, how they would be mobilized. So I'm not talking about the permafrost, I'm talking about the additional sources on the ocean shelves. And he came to the conclusion, together with his colleagues, that there will be a very slow release when the planet warms of the methane from these cleft rates over 1,000 years maybe. He calls it an extremely slow tipping point. The problem is, once it gets started, it's irreversible. And it would add another huge amount of carbon or methane to the atmosphere. When we have something on the Atlantic meridional overturning, the thermohaline circulation, and finally Mario Molinas and others speculate on how this discontinuity dynamics with tipping points should enter considerations when we seal a global deal on global warming. Because the politicians, of course, do not think in discontinuities and non-linearities. So let me conclude speaking about the unspeakable, that is runaway greenhouse effect. And Anders Lieberman and another have done a fairly simple calculation. Now, what are the forces which we have to consider? The first one is the black body radiation, which goes to the fourth power of global mean temperature, which is, in a sense, equilibrizing everything we are doing. So this is the derivative of that is this line here. So if you change by 1 degree the global mean temperature, then, of course, this radiation goes up, and it's a negative feedback, if you like. That's very important. But there are positive feedbacks, and this is calculated here. If you add 1 degree warming, for example, you have water vapor, positive feedback, but you also release from permafrost, for example, carbon, you change the albedo of the planet, vegetation dieback, and so on. So in a sense, this was an attempt to say, here we have the negative feedback, let's measure the same metric, so to speak, the positive feedbacks, and then, of course, you have human intervention and human interference as a, not a feedback, but a force, which is actually shifting us along the temperature line, whether the feedbacks exist or not. And this is the conceptual approach. The question is there something like a runaway greenhouse effect? It's called the Venus effect. You would reach a certain point when a system starts to amplify its warming by itself. So you're just like pushing something over the ridge, and then by gravitation it gets accelerated and accelerated. We don't think there is such a thing on this planet. It never happened in history. The other thing happened, namely snowball Earth. So a runaway glaciation actually happened twice, probably. But we have not seen, probably we have no evidence for a runaway greenhouse effect. But there can be something like a limited runaway greenhouse effect, where you enter a temperature T1, and when the system by itself pushes temperature to that other level here, and this could be a jump in temperature of centuries, whatever, by 5 degrees or something. And we cannot exclude that yet. So if you do the calculations, so the IPCC has, of course, looked at the feedbacks here, right, and has calculated, well, the distance to something like a runaway greenhouse effect, that means the positive feedbacks would have to add up to reach that line here, is just something like 1 watt per square meter, which is not much, actually, because you have to add human interference, clearly. The calculation which has to be done, you have to look at all the missing feedbacks. So it's oceanic CO2 uptake, it's albedo from Greenland melting. Greenland is, again, the black horse in the race. It's probably the Achilles heel of this planet. You have thawing of permafrost and so on. You have something, I recall, I have given a lecture in this very room, actually, 10 years ago, Richard Betts has reminded me of that with Jim Lovelock. It was about Gaia hypothesis and so on at that time. So the DMS, the cooling by sort of a Gaia, negative Gaia feedback by producing the right organic material to produce clouds and so on and cool the planet, was en vogue and has been heavily discussed. Actually, it is a feedback, a negative feedback, more or less one of the very few we can think of. Whether it's strong enough is a completely different thing. I don't think so. You see, most of the colors are red, so they add up. So it may be that if we go beyond the 2 degrees line, say 3 degrees, some of these things may add up to overcome and to overthrow the Stefan Boltzmann law, namely the black body radiation, and when the system will move by itself to a higher temperature. Whether we'll enter ever something like a Venus process that would mean that all the oceans would have to evaporate and so on, I don't think it will ever happen. Unfortunately, we have never calculated this, and it can't be done with the state-of-the-art GCMs, of course. So we are thinking in Potsdam about doing first conceptual models about it, writing down the right nonlinear equations, and just to open up this field. But I think this is extremely important to do this. Anyway, so I'm done now. I've shown you that a number of exciting futures are ahead of us, including a runaway greenhouse effect, perhaps. But we should better do the calculations before we do this real experiment. Thank you very much.